Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Today we'll have news about a raid by state law enforcement officials at the home of former California Public Utilities Chairman Michael Peavy, and why one local activist says she believes this is only the tip of the iceberg in corruption allegations involving the state regulatory agency. This weekend was exciting for Super Bowl fans and for Chargers fans as well. Hear which former Chargers player has just been named to football's Hall of Fame. We'll also tell you about an apartment fire in Santee that injured two people and a landslide in Alpine that damaged a local business. Speaking of landslides, Supervisor Diane Jacob won her last election by a landslide. East County Supervisor has announced plans to seek a final term before term limits kick in, but this time she could face some stiff opposition. Find out who may take a run for her seat and which special interests stand to benefit if a certain prominent politician decides to throw his hat into the ring. As for curbing the powers of special interests in local politics, today our newsmaker interview is with John Hartley from Neighborhoods for Clean Elections. He'll tell us about efforts to get a measure on local ballots, calling for clean election campaign options in the city of San Diego. Today we'll also tell you about the county's new Feeling Fit clubs for senior citizens, including two locations just added in East County. Later in the show, we'll take you on the road to the Desert View Tower in Hukumba Hot Springs. On Tribal Beat, learn why congressional approval of a copper mine has left Native Americans saddened and outraged. And on Bookshelf, Raina Menashe interviews author Paula Margulies about her novels told from a Native American point of view. In addition, we'll tell you where low-income families can get free car seats to help keep their children safe. We'll have all these stories for you and more, so stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. Investigators from the California Attorney General's office have raided the home of former Public Utilities Commission Chairman Michael Peavy, seizing computers and smartphones. State law enforcement officials also seized evidence from the home of Pacific Gas and Electric Company executive Brian Cherry, the San Francisco Chronicle reports. Peavy resigned in December, and Cherry was fired over illicit communications with PUC staff. Advocates for ratepayers in San Diego have long complained that Peavy represented the interests of utilities, not ratepayers or the public. The raids are part of an investigation into allegations of improper communications between Peavy and other PUC officials with PG&E executives. Emails obtained through public records revealed that Peavy and staff sought to help PG&E evade responsibility for the deadly San Bruno gas pipeline explosion that killed eight people and leveled an entire neighborhood. Peavy even offered to control the selection of administrative law judges in a rate-setting case. He also helped solicit campaign contributions to oppose a ballot measure that utilities objected to, and he solicited funds from the utility giant to pay for a centennial celebration for the PUC, the very same agency that is supposed to regulate utilities, not pander to their wishes. Mike Aguirre, former San Diego City Attorney, challenged Peavy at a public hearing last year over Peavy's cozy ties to Southern California Edison and questioned his impartiality in the San Onofre nuclear power plant controversy. Peavy, clearly peeved, refused to answer Aguirre's questions and told him to shut up, even though Aguirre was representing California ratepayers' interests at the proceeding. Now, Susan Brinkman with the Center for Electrosmog Prevention, a La Mesa resident who has been battling the PUC over smart meter proceedings, tells East County Magazine that she believes Peavy unduly influenced decisions on those issues as well. Brinkman says, judges who appear sympathetic to the consumer were regularly changed out for those who would do what Peavy wanted, which meant what the utilities wanted. For instance, she says, at each proceeding, the PUC refused to cover health and safety within the scope of the proceeding, contrary to PUC policy and state law. Now, Brinkman's organization has filed for a rehearing due to that stance for the Phase 2 smart meter opt-out proceeding, which recently closed after a decision favorable to the utilities. Peavy pushed through adoption of his proposal for the smart meter opt-out, which was adopted by the commission in December, just days before he resigned. According to Brinkman, he also treated ratepayers badly who had traveled from Southern California to San Francisco to testify about health problems they believed were caused by exposure to pulsed radiation from smart meters. Brinkman says she is also asking the state attorney general to look into intervener fees, noting that hefty rewards are typically given to those who support utility positions, while interveners such as Aguirre, who oppose utilities' views, tend to be denied compensation or given trifling amounts. Brinkman adds, the PUC is a completely corrupted, rogue state agency that is endangering the public, extending far beyond Peavy. The key staff are frequently recycled utility attorneys or top staff from utility companies, and they do whatever the utilities want. It doesn't seem to matter how dangerous, she says. Carol Brown, Michael Peavy's chief of staff, who was forced to resign in September, is now an administrative law judge at the PUC, making decisions daily that impact consumer health and safety. That's after Brown was caught making deals to help PG&E after its gas line pipeline blew up in San Bruno, killing 8 people. Among those killed was a PUC staffer who had become a whistleblower on gas pipeline leaks, along with her young daughter. Their house was ground zero for the explosion, the Los Angeles Times has reported. That staffer, Jacqueline Grieg, worked for an independent branch of the PUC called the Division of Ratepayer Advocates, which takes the side of utility customers in matters before the PUC. In addition to the state investigation of Peavy and staff, the federal government is also reportedly conducting a separate investigation to determine just whose interests the PUC chairman was representing and whether state and federal laws were violated. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
Former San Diego Chargers linebacker Junior Seau was elected for induction into the Pro Football Hall of Fame on Saturday in his very first year of eligibility. Dean Spanos, Chargers chairman of the board, recalls, "From the day we drafted Junior, we knew he was special." Spanos says Seau's athletic ability was clear, but it was his passion and energy that separated him from the rest of the league. He adds, "It's that same passion for life that made him an icon in San Diego." Junior certainly is deserving of being a first ballot inductee into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Former Chargers head coach Bobby Ross called Seau the absolute best as a player and said the honor is richly deserved. ESPN's Mike Tirico recalled Seau as a player who made the scripted play and the unscripted play, noting that it's rare for a linebacker to become the face of an NFL franchise. The Chargers have had great players in recent years, he said, including LaDainian Tomlinson, yet Seau was the face, the energy, and the passion of the Chargers. Few players in sports have influenced a franchise the way Seau impacted the Chargers. Only the third player in team's history to have his number retired, Seau was inducted into the team's Hall of Fame in 2011. While the Hall of Fame selection committee from the NFL elected Seau in his very first year of eligibility, it failed to recognize the outstanding accomplishments and contributions of former head coach Don Coryell. After 13 seasons in San Diego, Seau continued his NFL career with the Miami Dolphins and New England Patriots. For his career, he notched 56.5 sacks, 18 interceptions, and recorded 10 or more tackles in a game 64 times. Seau was voted to a team record 12 consecutive Pro Bowls and was named to the All-Decade Team of the 1990s by the Pro Football Hall of Fame. He was a first-team All-Pro pick 6 times and the Most Valuable Player, a team record 6 times, as well as Defensive Player of the Year twice. Seau died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound in 2012. An analysis of his brain by the National Institute of Health found damage from chronic traumatic encephalopathy, a degenerative disease with depression caused by multiple concussions incurred during his illustrious NFL career, a career that brought him fame but also contributed to his early demise, according to a lawsuit filed by Seau's family. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this has been Leon Thompson.
Things were rocking and rolling in Alpine early Sunday morning. A landslide sent a large boulder smashing into the back of Alpine Rentals on Alpine Boulevard, also severing a gas line. Though the building sustained significant damage, fortunately there were no injuries, 10 News reports, since the business was closed at the time the rock slide occurred. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ out here in Rocky Alpine, this is Miriam Raftery.
A young girl was injured after a fire broke out downstairs from the apartment she was in with her grandmother Friday afternoon on Mission Gorge Road in Santee. Channel 10 News reports a firefighter battling the blaze also sustained injury. Mayron Farad told 10 News that his roommates were home but sleeping at the time and added that an explosion near the kitchen awakened them. The roommates escaped safely. The injured girl and firefighter were reportedly taken to a hospital for treatment. The two apartment units were declared a total loss from the fire. The cause of the blaze has not yet been determined. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
The race to represent San Diego's East County on the San Diego County Board of Supervisors is kicking off early. Supervisor Diane Jacob has announced plans to seek re-election in 2016 for what would be her final term of office under term limits passed by voters. She is seeking early support in an email signed by 16 community leaders, Times of San Diego reports. That email praises Jacob's, quote, courage to stand up for us on issues ranging from securing aid for fire victims to helping homeowners win clean energy options. The email also warns of termed-out politicians who could run against her. That might include State Senator Joel Anderson, who has already launched a campaign committee to run for supervisor in the 2nd Supervisor District in 2020 for what would then be an open seat due to term limits, the Reader reports. But the UT San Diego suggests Anderson may jump in sooner, in 2016, and could win support of the Republican Party for an effort to unseat Jacob. Those signing the letter on Jacob's behalf include former La Mesa Councilman Ernie Ewan, ex-San Diego Zoo Ambassador Joan Embry of Lakeside, and local planning board members. The email to Jacob's supporters asked for endorsement and states it would be a tragedy if a politician whose only interests are advancing a political career and delivering for special interest supporters replaced a committed public servant like Diane. Jacob, a Republican, has held the office for over two decades. In her last two elections, she defeated Democrat Rudy Reyes, a Cedar Fire survivor and burn victim, by wide margins. Democrats have not yet announced who they may field to run against Jacob in 2016. Her district is the largest countywide, including the cities of El Cajon, La Mesa, Lemon Grove, Poway, and Santee, as well as the unincorporated areas of the county. The County Republican Party is reportedly unhappy over supervisors' recent vote to limit campaign contributions by political parties to $25,000 in supervisor races. Tony Kravarik, chair of the San Diego County Republican Party, suggests those caps may have been due to Anderson's potential candidacy. The UT reports that Kravarik blamed Jacob for the move, which he called a stunt, even though three of her Republican colleagues joined her in voting for the campaign finance limits, with only Supervisor Bill Horn voting no. Jacob has been a fighter standing up against destructive energy projects and industrial zoning in the backcountry and San Diego's inland regions, from Sunrise Power Link to the county's wind energy ordinance. Anderson, by contrast, refused to take stances on major energy projects such as Quail Brush, Thule Wind, and Sunrise Power Link, despite many requests from his constituents to do so. Anderson has long positioned himself as a tax fighter championing taxpayers and has a record of fiscal conservatism, but Jacob backers also praise her record of balanced budgets. Anderson previously served on the Helix Water District Board before his election to the legislature. He has been an effective money raiser for the Republican Party, but he has also drawn controversy over his own political contributions. Anderson has received large campaign funding from Sempra Energy, parent corporation of SDG&E, as well as from Hammond Construction family members. In 2009, Anderson was fined $20,000 by the Fair Political Practices Commission under a plea bargain arrangement for illegally funneling money from Sempra, Hammond family members, and others into his campaign through a Republican Central Committee. The donations exceeded state limits for donors, and Anderson returned the illegal contributions. Hammond owns part of the land slated for the controversial Thule Wind project, and Anderson also leases his office space in a building owned by Hammond. Senator Anderson has not yet stated publicly whether he will challenge Jacob in 2016 or hold off until her seat is open 4 years later. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording from our studio in the East County Wellness Center here in El Cajon. My very special guest today is John Hartley, and John is the coordinator of Neighborhoods for Clean Elections in San Diego. John, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
Tell us what Neighborhoods for Clean Elections is all about.
Well, it's a citizens group. Our goal is to empower our neighborhoods through clean elections. For the city of San Diego is where we want to start, and our goal is to put a clean elections initiative on the ballot for the presidential election year 2016 in the city of San Diego.
For those listeners who may not be aware, can you explain what clean elections are?
It's a funny term. A lot of people don't know what clean elections. Clean elections is public financing of elections. It's a system whereby people can earn the right for public money to run their campaigns.
And what would they have to do to earn that public money?
They would have to get the support of a large number of people in the district they're running in. Mm-hmm. In San Diego, it would be city council district, or if they're running for mayor in the whole city. They'd have to get a small donation from a large number of people to demonstrate that they're actually viable candidates.
Right. And then they have to agree not to accept money from, say, special interests or large individual donors. Is that correct?
Yes. If they earn the right for public funding, they can't spend any of their own money. They can't go solicit money from anyone else. So they're not beholden to anyone else. And if they win office, then they're actually free to represent each and every person in their district, not the special interest.
So it's a means of getting the special interests out of politics on a voluntary basis. And I understand that there would actually be a clean elections symbol that would appear on the ballot, so voters would know if somebody is running as a clean election candidate who has not accepted any of that special interest money or put, you know, large sums of their own money into the campaign.
Yes, that's what we've written an initiative. It's on our ballot, on our webpage, www.sdcleanelections.org. Mm-hmm. And we propose that the Clean Elections Program, if it passes, is administered by the Ethics Commission mm-hmm. in the city of San Diego.
Now, of course, this would not stop an opponent from refusing to be a clean elections candidate and taking millions of dollars from wherever they can get it. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's strictly voluntary. And our proposals for the city of San Diego, strictly voluntary. People could run it if they're a millionaire, they could spend their own money, or if they're mm-hmm. Connected to special interest, they could run in with special interest funding.
But people would know that. They'd be able to tell that on the ballot. Now, it seems like it would be really hard to win against somebody who's a millionaire, but what has actually happened in places where clean elections have become the law?
Well, we have clean elections in Arizona and Maine since 2000.
The entire states there.
Yeah. And what happens, it levels the playing field. More women, people of color, elected to office, mm-hmm. and it limits the influence of special interest.
Yeah, it makes it so that ordinary people are able to run. Now, in San Diego, you've said the limit or the amount that you would get in public financing would be, what, about $125,000?
Yeah. Right now, it's around $100,000. We're thinking about increasing it to $125,000.
An old initiative.
Because it's been a while since we set that standard, and the funding's going up tremendously. Yes.
You've told me you ran for council before, and how much did you spend, or did you raise?
Well, the first time I ran for city council, I raised $3,000.
Yeah, which would make it very difficult to obviously. Even for a very wonderful candidate, that it's hard to win.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
For a lot of ordinary people, $125,000 might sound like a lot of money. I mean, they might be very willing to sign and say, I won't take any special interest money if I can get that $125,000 of public money.
Well, you would have to earn that right, and mm-hmm. by getting 500 people in the city of San Diego to contribute $5 to the Clean Money Fund.
Yeah, which can be difficult to do. So.
Right. We set the bar pretty high
because
we don't want to make it easy to get public funding.
You don't want 100 candidates qualifying for that or something. Very interesting. What would you say to those people who would say, why should taxpayers be paying candidates to run for office, essentially?
Well, we think the elections are so critical to our social world. Think about it. Those people in office make decisions that impact all of us, kids, families, seniors. that that some public funding is a positive part of the process. Mm-hmm. We have no problems with it at all because we think it really empowers our neighborhoods and all people in our city of San Diego.
So it could mean more money flowing to neighborhoods and perhaps less flowing to, say, development projects that might favor special interests that gave a lot of money to the council, for example,
right.
The council candidates.
I mean, today, I mean, what we get is those people who contribute large amounts of money get a large amount of influence.
Right, whether it's business groups or labor groups or utilities, whoever it might be.
Right, and so we just feel that regular people should get support so that everybody is treated equally by our elected representatives.
Now, with the Citizens United ruling, I guess the one monkey wrench that throws into it is that, you know, they've said that you can't stop an individual or an organization from putting money into a campaign if they choose an independent expenditure campaign. So, in theory, you could still have – you could have your millionaire candidate running against a clean elections candidate. And let's say if the millionaire decides to run a smear campaign all over TV about the guy who's used up his $100,000 – is there the potential still that an independent expenditure campaign could come forth to support a clean elections candidate, or would that violate the rule somehow?
Well, the way it is, the Supreme Court says that business are people, and so therefore they can contribute. And they also say that any individual can spend as much money as they want.
So if I want to run an independent expenditure campaign for somebody I like, regardless of whether they're a clean election campaign or not, somebody could still do that. This doesn't.
Absolutely.
You legally can't prevent that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's strictly voluntary. And as long as there's no communication and
right.
coordination.
Right. Candidate can't be involved, can't know about it,
right.
can't control that or have any ties to their campaign for
right.
that. Yeah.
So people now could still run as a traditional campaign with clean elections because clean mm-hmm. elections is a voluntary program.
Right. So what's the next step here? You're going to be starting a petition-gathering campaign. How many signatures do you have to get?
With our initiative process in the city of San Diego, probably covers all the cities in California, we have about 6 months to run a campaign, a citizens' campaign.
Mm-hmm.
You have to publicize for about 45 days, and then you have to get your signatures. In the city of San Diego, we need to get about 60,000 signatures.
That's a lot of signatures.
That's a lot of signatures. And we'll start publicizing probably November of 2015, and we'll start getting initiative going around January 2016. We got to turn our signatures in around June of mm-hmm. 2016.
Okay. If people want to get more information or they want to be on your mailing list for when these petitions become available, how would they get in touch with you?
We have a webpage. It's www.sdcleanelections.org. And we have everything on there. We have our initiative on there, our endorsements. They could reach me on there, John Hartley. I'm the mm-hmm. coordinator. My phone number is there. And our email is there. That's how somebody could reach us.
Very good. And it should be noted that campaign financing is something that actually has been done in the past, public financing in some presidential elections last time around. Both candidates opted not to take it, but it's been done in the past. So there is certainly precedent at a high level for that, as well as in the states of Maine and Arizona, as you've noted.
Absolutely, at the presidential level. Also, the city of New York has clean elections, mm-hmm. and now the city of Albuquerque, New Mexico, has clean elections.
Very good. Well, John, I want to thank you very much for joining us here today from the Neighborhoods for Clean Elections campaign, and we appreciate you taking the time to join us here on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you. Appreciate it. I'm honored to be here. Thanks.
San Diego County's older adults have new opportunities to stretch, lift weights, and help maintain an active lifestyle as the county's popular Feeling Fit Club expands with new locations in East County. The Rancho San Diego Library will offer Feeling Fit classes on Mondays and Wednesdays from 8:30 to 9:30 a.m. In addition, the El Cajon Salvation Army will hold classes on Monday and Wednesdays from 10 until 11 a.m. Countywide Feeling Fit clubs are now held in 31 locations. The clubs are functional fitness classes for older adults designed to strengthen major muscle groups, highlighting the exercise and socialization components of wellness. The classes are 1 hour long, 2 to 3 times a week. According to the county, Feeling Fit clubs offer a safe, comfortable environment for older adults to develop and maintain their level of physical fitness while also engaging in social interaction and self-esteem building. The classes aim to improve the ability of older adults to maintain their independence. An hour-long Feeling Fit club program can also be viewed at 8 a.m. and again at 1 p.m. Monday through Friday on the San Diego County News Center TV or CNC TV. For more information on Feeling Fit clubs, you can call 858-495-5998. This has been Leon Thompson reporting for East County Magazine.
We're on the road in East County, visiting some amazing towns and meeting some incredible people across our region. Welcome to another adventure on East County Magazine's On the Road.
This is Hayden Parsley, on the road in Hucumba Hot Springs for East County Magazine. You can take a trip into California's past at the Desert View Tower, a quirky and whimsical relic of the past that is still open to the public here in San Diego's East County. Located just off Interstate 8 at the Incapa exit, the tower is poised on a rocky overlook surrounded by desert on all sides. Built in the 1920s by Bert Vaughn, a real estate tycoon who owned much of Hucumba, this 70-foot watchtower has become a tourist attraction and a local landmark on the outskirts of the small town known as Hucumba Hot Springs. Originally built to commemorate the area's rough pre-highway history, the tower houses a small museum filled with artifacts and oddities of California's history, including our region's Native American, Spanish, and pioneer past. The top floor of the tower is an observation deck, with a coin-fed telescope that provides a breathtaking view of Imperial Valley and the Anza-Borrego Desert, though now somewhat marred by a wind farm. In 1950, a gift shop was added around the base of the tower. The shop still operates today and is filled with an eclectic mix of items such as geodes, gems and minerals, vintage postcards, historic and travel books on our region, arts and crafts items such as handmade Tecate tiles, onyx bookends, musical instruments, carved animal sculptures, and more. Roaming this area of the tower are the owner's many friendly dogs that add to the rustic charm of the location. You can also get a workout pumping a player piano while listening to old-time tunes. While I was there, the wind was gusting. It was a bit chilly and I wished I had a better coat when I reached the top. The owner says this is atypical though and that it is warm and sunny most days. The proprietor, Ben Schultz, has many colorful stories on East County's history, culture, and colorful characters, having operated the site for many years. Boulder Park at the Desert View Tower was created in 1933 by an unemployed engineer, Merle Ratcliffe, who was out of work during the Great Depression. He sculpted reptiles and fanciful animals out of the huge stone boulders. I didn't get a chance to tour these, which will be an adventure for another time.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
This is East County Magazine's Tribal Beat, bringing you news for and about our region's Native American communities. This is Leon Thompson with the Tribal Beat Report on East County Magazine. The United States Senate passed a measure authorizing the nation's defense programs and along with it managed to give lands sacred to Native Americans to a foreign company that owns a uranium mine with Iran. The addition to the Defense Authorization Act of the Arizona land swap were never discussed in public and were added during secret negotiations between the House and Senate Armed Services Committees. The deal was never publicly revealed until the House started work on passing the entire defense bill last week. The National Defense Authorization Act of 2015 is legislation that Congress passes every year, but like they did on attaching extraneous riders to the must-pass government funding bill, lawmakers used the $585 billion defense bill as a vehicle to give protected public land away to a controversial foreign mining company to make billions of dollars selling copper to China. The deal gives a subsidiary of the Australian-English mining firm Rio Tinto 2,400 acres of the Tonto National Forest so it can mine a massive copper deposit in exchange for several diverse parcels. The Southeast Arizona Land Exchange and Conservation Act has twice failed to win support in the House of Representatives, blocked by Republicans and Democrats, liberals and conservatives. In fact, the copper mine project is widely opposed. A broad coalition of southwestern tribal nations and Indian country in general, the Sierra Club and other environmental groups who say the mine will devastate the water that feeds the area's aquifers. They've thwarted Rio Tinto's efforts to acquire the land over the past decade. Both the National Congress of American Indians and the United South and Eastern Tribes have passed resolutions opposing the land swap and mining proposal. According to the Huffington Post, Senator John McCain, Republican of Arizona, has been the lead supporter over the years of Rio Tinto's efforts to acquire the land. McCain was instrumental in attaching the land swap bill into the National Defense Authorization Act at the last minute. The Iran connection comes from a uranium mine in Namibia in which Tehran has owned a 15% stake since the days of the Shah. Richard Sully, coordinator of the London Mining Network, an alliance of human rights, development, environmental, and solidarity groups, says that Rio Tinto is enormous. Its history of attacks on workers' rights and environmental destruction has had a particularly damaging impact across the world. All this is reported by the Guardian of London. And according to the Guardian of London, during the first years of operation, the Namibia uranium mine operated with a migrant labor system, which the International Commission of Jurists declared illegal and said was similar to slavery. Black workers lived on the mine premises and were exposed to dust and radiation 24 hours a day, and the mine became the focus for protests by anti-apartheid and anti-nuclear groups. Shares in the mine are owned 69% by UK-based Rio Tinto and 15% by the government of Iran. Namibian government has denied supplying Iran with Namibian uranium, which could be used for nuclear weapons. Native Americans, particularly the Apache tribe in the area, say digging a massive mine, said to be a copper ore deposit that is a cubic mile large, under the ancestral lands will physically destroy sacred ceremonial and burial grounds. The San Carlos Apache tribe has worked for the past decade to shine light on the Southeast Arizona land exchange that would transfer Oak Flat and nearby lands in the Tonto National Forest, lands held sacred by the Apaches and many other First Nation Americans, to a foreign-owned mining corporation for certain destruction. Sadly, this land exchange has been inserted into the National Defense Authorization Act for 2015 at the 11th hour as Congress prepares to bring the 113th Congress session to a close. Hundreds of tribal governments, tribal organizations, and others have joined the San Carlos Apaches in opposition to the land exchange because it would transfer public federal lands that encompass a known native place of worship to a private mining company. In the face of this opposition, certain members of Arizona's delegation forced a closed-door deal to include the Southeast Arizona Land Exchange into the National Defense Authorization Act of 2015. The land exchange was included in Section 3003 on page 1103 of a 1,700-page bill that was unveiled after 11 p.m. the evening before it came up for consideration. This is exactly what is wrong with Congress and why its approval rating is so low. The act would direct the Secretary of Agriculture to convey over 2,400 acres of the forest. The area around Oak Flat is known as the forest, to a mining company called Resolution Copper, which is owned by the foreign mining giants Rio Tinto and BHP Billiton Limited from Australia. The area to be mined is called the Forest, established in 1905 from Apache ancestral homelands. The Forest is named after the Tonto Apaches who were forced from the Oak Flat area in the 1870s and imprisoned at Camp Verde Reservation. The reservation is located 15 miles from Oak Flat. During the winter of 1875, the Apache prisoners of war were forced marched to San Carlos Reservation by the military. Over 100 Tonto Apaches died during that winter march. It seems that history is repeating itself. Apache Chairman Terry Rambler wrote, "Oak Flat is a place of irreplaceable beauty. President Eisenhower specifically withdrew the area from mining through a public lands order. President Nixon reaffirmed withdrawal. However, Rio Tinto and the Resolution Copper Company seek to develop and operate the largest copper mine in North America in the Oak Flat area. Resolution Copper plans to use the highly destructive block cave mining method to remove 1 cubic mile of ore, the equivalent of 1,400 stadiums, 7,000 feet beneath the surface of the earth, without replacing any of the earth removed, because it is the cheapest form of mining. Resolution Copper itself admits that the surface will collapse, creating a crater visible from outer space and destroying forever this place of worship. The transfer and resulting mine will forever alter the region's water quality and water supply. Copper is one of the most water-intensive forms of mining in existence. Add block cave mining into the factor, and the need for water further intensifies. The U.S. established the Tonto National Forest in 1904 to protect the region's watershed. This protection will also turn to dust with the land exchange. The beneficiaries of the land transfer, Resolution Copper Mining and its parent corporation, Rio Tinto, will reap billions in American taxpayer resources. They are earmarked to reap these benefits without any guarantee that the copper remains in the U.S. Resolution Copper Project Director Andrew Tamplin admitted in a recent Arizona Central article that the copper ore mined from Oak Flat will likely be shipped out of the country to be smelted. Rio Tinto's top shareholder, Chinalco, a corporation owned by the government of China, cannot wait for this deal to pass. The proponents of the act claim that the bill was amended to address the tribe's concerns with protections, sacred places, and environmental concerns. These claims are hollow, though, because despite changes to require consultation with affected tribes and compliance with the National Environmental Protection Act, it still mandates the transfer of Oak Flat into the private ownership of Resolution Copper, regardless of the results of the consultation or the information and recommendations resulting from the National Environmental Protection Agency process. A mandatory conveyance defeats the purpose of tribal consultations and the National Environmental Protection Agency process that are designed to help provide information before decisions about transferring the land are made. The Southwest Arizona land grab, the outcome is predetermined. Is rendering tribal views and public comments meaningless. Furthermore, Section 3003 would not require Resolution Copper to mitigate impacts on the Oak Flat area after conveyance and contains no repercussions or penalties on Resolution Copper for environmental harm or the destruction of significant and sacred areas. Tribal Chairman Rambler went on to say, Oak Flat is one of our religious places where our Gaon, spiritual deities, and holy people reside. Apache people have lived, prayed, and died in Oak Flat area since time immemorial. We are saddened that Congress, through an 11th-hour rider, has ignored the will of the people. We are concerned for our children who may never see or practice their religion in their rightful place of worship. We are worried for the children of Southeast Arizona who may have to find new places to live to drink clean water. And we are gravely concerned for the American voter whose voice continues to be ignored. However, the Apache people will not remain silent. We are committed to shining light on the land exchange and the proposed mine until we have no breath.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm speaking with Paula Margulies, award-winning author of the historical novel Favorite Daughter, Part 1. She's also written the novel Coyote Heart and a short story collection called Face Value, Collected Stories. My guest is also a contributor to Author Magazine, the San Diego Examiner, and the Writer's Edge. She owns and runs Paula Margulies Communications, a public relations firm for authors and artists. Welcome, Paula. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Let's begin with your new novel, Favorite Daughter, Part 1. This is the Pocahontas story, but it's told from her perspective. What prompted you to tell such a well-known and iconic story from the Native American point of view, instead of from John Smith's?
Well, you know, I wrote my first novel, which was set here in San Diego, a contemporary novel, and it was called Coyote Heart, and it was set on the Pala Indian Reservation. So it had a Native American story to it, a theme to it. Mm-hmm. And finished that novel and decided, you know, I was going to write a sequel to it or something similar. And at that time, I happened to read a book by Sina Jeter Naslin, a historical novel called Abundance, which was about Marie Antoinette, the life of Marie Antoinette. And she told the story from her point of view, rather than the traditional history right. we've heard about the French Revolution and let them eat cake and all of that.
Right.
She let Marie Antoinette tell her version of what happened. And she was 14 years old when she was first brought to France to marry this king. And it was fascinating. And just to hear that first person voice and get that sure. female perspective on history, I thought, oh, I want to do that. Uh-huh. So I thought, okay, who would I write about? And I've always been interested in Pocahontas. I grew up here in California where we learned, California history in fourth grade when we visited the missions and all of that. So I didn't really know the Pocahontas story. And when I started to read her story, I read both the John Smith version of history, some of his writing, some of the historians that were out there, Massacre and Helen Roundtree. And then I came across some Native American tellings of her story. And the one that was most interesting to me was written by Dr. Linwood Costello, who's a Mattaponi Indian, and with the help of Angela Daniel, who is also Mattaponi. And their version of her story was, he claimed, handed down through oral tradition, 400 years of oral tradition. And his version was very different than the John Smith version. And I thought, oh, here's the story I'd like to tell. And I'd like to let her tell it just
right.
the way Naslin did in her book. So that's how the whole thing came about.
So it's really like uncovering the real story.
Yeah.
And I know that it's this one, the story of Pocahontas, from her point of view, that it's darker than the version that we're familiar with. Tell us about that. How did your research lead you to this darker version? And why do you think it hasn't made its way into popular storytelling until now?
That's a great question. You know, I think so much of history has a male perspective. I think in this case, John Smith wrote quite a bit about his time in the colonies, and that's because the Virginia Company of London had hired him to come to the new land and find, you know, this, you know, gold and whatever other natural resources they were looking for. And so a lot of his writing was, I think his purpose was to make himself look good and to make the colonists right. look good and to make the venture look successful. So the focus was more, I think, on that perspective. And I think the natives that they met along the way were incorporated into his version of the story in order to show him in a good light. Well, when you read the native version of the story, according to Dr. Costello, it's much darker. Gosh, when she first met John Smith, she was 11 years old. She was a young girl. So the romanticized version of the relationship between her and Smith, he was 27 when he came in 1607 to the colony. Yeah, so there's a huge age gap there. I, in my imagination and from what I've read in history, I think they were very good friends. I think they were fascinated with each other, mm-hmm. but she was a very young girl. And so, according to Costello, there never was that romantic relationship. But there was a political reason for her to be involved in that her father saw that she had this, you know, kind of friendship with Smith, and he kind of used that. In fact, she was kind of used by all the men in her life, mm-hmm. and that's a lot of the story,
yeah.
is kind of the betrayal and just the way she figured in the history. But according to Costello, it was very dark. She was abducted, which is a known fact in history, after she married Kokoam, and there is dispute over whether he even existed. But for those historians who say she was married to this native, Kokoam, she lived in his village, and his uncle was the chief of the tribe, and the uncle conspired with the colonists for the abduction. They were the ones who actually lured her onboard ship, and her father did not rescue her. I mean, they kind of held her for ransom, and he said, no, I'm not going to do it. And I think that broke her heart in a lot of ways. And so according to Dr. Costello, when she converted to Christianity, this was coerced. She was held there against her will. According to him, she was raped by the governor of the colony at the time, Thomas Gates. And in fact, he claims that the marriage to John Rolfe, she later married a colonist, that that marriage was coerced and that the child that she had with Rolfe was actually from the rape. And that's what the child's name is, Thomas. So according to the oral tradition, this all happened. And at the end of her story, she eventually, you know, married John Rolfe and became kind of a figurehead in England, very well known as kind of a celebrity, and they brought her over later to England. She met the king and queen, and she later connected with John Smith, who had left in 1609. He burned his thigh in a gunshot incident. I don't know if gunpowder went off in a boat or something. He burned himself. He decided he had to go back to England to take care of that, and he never came back. And she was devastated by that. In fact, when she went to Jamestown right after he left and said, "Where is he?" they told her that he had died. So when she eventually was brought to England, she ran into him. And a lot of historians have a document in this. So they did meet, and she was very angry with him when she met him. But on the way home from that voyage, the traditional history is that she developed a case of pneumonia and she died. She's 21 years old. She only lived for 10 years. But the Mattaponi Indians, Dr. Costello, in his version, he claims that she was murdered, that she was poisoned. And so it's just a different kind of perspective on the whole thing and how, you know, what her life was really like.
And it really makes us look at, you know, when we judge history by the story that we're handed, we don't always see it from the perspective of the details of the person involved. If she was 11 years old and she was exploited, it puts a whole different light on everything.
It does. It does. And she was an amazing person. I mean, I imagine her as someone who was fascinated with these foreigners, who was fascinated with the idea of another world, who wanted to see that world. Also, she's very astute. She was good at the language, at learning the English language. And, I think her father saw that in her. And that's why she kind of became a conduit between the colonists and the tribes. And, so she played an amazing role in history. At the same time, she was kind of used.
Right.
And so it's kind of interesting just to see that native perspective.
Versus a gifted, curious young woman.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or a young girl, I should say, in the beginning. How about you? Are you Native American heritage?
I am not. I'm full-blooded Italian, both sides. Although my father was always interested in Native history and Native artifacts, so I kind of grew up with, you know, a respect for Native culture and traditions and music and art. And he was very much into that. He passed away a year ago, and so that was something I grew up with that. So I've always had that interest.
So you've crossed cultures as well.
A little bit. Yeah, a little bit.
Now, let's go back to Pocahontas. She's from this native world where strangers appear in the shore of her village. When you were doing your research and you were learning about that lost world, can you share with us any details that really struck with you that you hadn't heard about previously that you think are the most telling of what life was like back then?
That's a good question. You know, as I imagine it, at the time when John Smith and the colonists first appeared in the New World, the Native American tribes there had encountered the Spaniards. They've already been visited by other European cultures, and those were not good encounters. And I think my sense from the history and what I've read is that they could tell that they were facing change, that these people that were coming now more often and more, that was one of their concerns when John Smith landed. Are there more? Are you going to live here? Are you, you know, what are you doing here? And as the supply vessels kept coming, they realized that these people are not going to go away. And there was some dispute among the tribe as to what to do. Chief Powhatan was friendly. He was curious about them, willing to trust them, but his interest was to have them help him fight the Spaniards if they ever return. His brother, Obachankano, also a chief, was not open to having them there and didn't want any kind of relationship with them. So there was a lot of, I think within the tribe, a lot of division and kind of disagreement over what to do. So I think it brought in a time of it was tumultuous and kind of frightening, and it kind of sad, because I think some of the natives there realized as more and more of the colonists arrived that their culture was going to change. And so it was a time of big change.
They saw the end coming, really.
They started to. Yeah, they started to. It was hard to accept, you know, and I think that led to a lot of mistakes in terms of the relationship and how they negotiated for themselves. And,
right.
Yeah, so it was interesting. And the world itself was, it was interesting writing this book because when I wrote my first book, that was a contemporary novel, mm-hmm. which was so easy to write in comparison to this historical because here in modern day, you can get in the car and go anywhere. You can take a plane. You can ride a bus. You can be in another country in a day. Back then, all the travel was on foot or by canoe, and that was it. So in writing that story, I realized how focused they were on the area they lived in and how much the natural world mattered to them because of that. This was the world they knew. And so setting a scene, you know, trying to transition scenes or make scenes appear in different places was tough because they didn't go anywhere. You know, this 11-year-old girl was heavily guarded. If she did go to Jamestown, in my book she does, a lot of people went with her. It was a full-day journey on foot. You know, that was the kind of thing you had to deal with. So in the setting itself was kind of limiting in some way, writing the historical. So mm-hmm. the challenge was to try and make different scenes happen in different areas within the village or within the forested area around them or within near Jamestown or on these rivers. But that's kind of the location issue you're dealing with in a historical. So it's different. You kind of very focused in on the landscape and the natural world, which is so important to the culture. So there's kind of a sadness in a sense too, to mm-hmm. see that, you know, the colonists came looking for natural resources. So, there was a lot of exploitation in that sense too. So it's kind of a sad time, time of change.
And when you're writing the book to immerse yourself in the mood of all that world, did you listen to music? Did you?
Oh. I burn incense when I write. It's always been my, as soon as I light that incense and I smell it, it's time to settle down and
write.
It
brings you back.
So, but I've always felt it's really important to have sensory detail in the writing, touches and smells and all of that. So you kind of have to imagine the setting because we're not on the East Coast here. And then write that into the story. And I think if you know your character well, you can kind of see it through her eyes and sense that world. And if you really immerse yourself in it and let her speak through you, you kind of, you have access to all of that.
Great point. Well, I know that in addition to writing and researching, you also market and promote other authors. What would you like to tell all those writers out there who envision a story and dream of making it come to life? Is it the sensory details, doing your research? Any advice for the writers out there?
I think the most important element of writing a story like this, or any story, is to really feel your characters, to immerse yourself in your characters, especially your main character. I think you have to know what she wants, what she longs for, what her dreams are, what her fears or hopes, her what she loves, what she hates. You have to have a deep, deep sense of who she is to write her story, especially if you're telling it in first person. You know, from a perspective of history, you have to have that. If you don't have that, I think you'd be lost. So I think that's the most important thing is to really feel the character, immerse yourself in character. And then those sensory details, to me personally, I just find that to be the most excruciatingly hard and important part of writing because I think you have to put the reader in the scene and have the reader see what she's seeing and what she's feeling and what she can touch and smell and hear. So yes, those sensory details are all part of it. And if it's happened in the past or if it's in an area you don't know well, you have to research that area. If there, you know, if there's nature involved or elements involved, you have to know the timing for those and what animals are in those areas.
Right.
And you have to understand all of that too. So
do your homework.
Yeah. Getting the sensory detail down and doing the homework, but mostly immersing yourself in the character. So after a while you hear her voice in your head and she speaks. I mean, you start to feel like you're channeling that person and she's writing her story. And then it's true. I think then at that point, the character takes over and the writer just gets out of the way.
Kind of. Wonderful. One last question, Paula.
Yes.
What book is next and when can we expect to see it?
Well, as you know, this is part one of her story. So This book focuses mainly on John Smith's arrival in the colony and some of the coming of age experiences that she has as an 11-year-old girl who's maturing, who's betrothed to be married, who's the daughter of a chief. So all of those events in her life are kind of captured in part one. Part two, the story picks up after John Smith leaves. She marries Kokoam. She's abducted, and then that part of the story happens next. So I'm writing part two right now, and it's going to take a couple of years, I think, to get that written and polished up. And then I have an idea for another novel later on. That one will be set in Hawaii. It takes place in Molokai in the time of Father Damien. So that's kind of cooking in the back burner right now, but I'm focused on part two right now of this story.
Well, Paula, our time is up, but thank you so much for joining us and telling us about your book.
Thank you for having me.
For more information on Paula Margulies, her work, and her blog, please visit her website at paulamargulies.com, and that's spelled PAULAMARGULIES. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
If you are low income and need a child car seat, the county has one for you. Nearly 2,000 child car seats will be distributed among low-income parents thanks to a $245,500 grant from the California Office of Traffic Safety. The free seats will be given out now through September 2015. Supervisor Diane Jacobs says, "The county is committed to doing all it can to keep children safe. This program helps low-income parents safeguard their children from injury and death. Motor vehicle injuries are the leading cause of death among children in the United States, yet most motor vehicle-related deaths and injuries are preventable. The grant, part of the Keep 'Em Safe program through the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, will also fund an education campaign, including presentations on the proper installation and use of a child passenger restraint system for children of all ages. The goal of the campaign is to increase the proper use of child car seats and seatbelt use and to educate parents about vehicle safety, including information on airbags and the dangers of leaving children alone in the car. This is the fifth year the county has received funding through the Keep 'Em Safe program. Last year, 2,155 child car seats were distributed throughout the region. Locally, Keep 'Em Safe will also include passenger safety education, classes to social workers, public health nurses, community outreach workers, and public safety workers. Nick Maccioni, director of the county's Health and Human Services Agency, says the cost of safety equipment can be a hardship for low-income families, especially in households with two or more children. He adds, the Keep 'Em Safe program works closely with community-based organizations to promote traffic safety programs in underserved communities such as refugees, Native Americans, and the military. For more information about Keep 'Em Safe programs and how to receive a free car seat, contact the Pacific Safety Center at 888-846-4200. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Priebel, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia, and the Smashing Beats. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.